And now you know why we had to file a lawsuit, because this has been normalized. When something of this magnitude happens, there is literally no response. That is so un-American. That is so dangerous. That is so infected with anti-Semitism. It's irrational. It doesn't make sense.
The flag will fight before the world.
What does it mean, fight back? We have a long fight ahead of us.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am.
Here I am. With Shai Davidai.
So here I am with Shabbos Kestenbaum.
Hey.
Hey, good, Shabbos.
Good to be here with you.
I am so, first of all, I'm so glad you could make it that you're here. But more important, I'm so glad that I have met you, that I've been following you, and now we've spent some time together, and that you are someone I can call my friend.
Likewise. And as I always tell you, we students are trying to do what we can, but the fact that we have professors and those in leadership positions who are advocating for us as well makes this all worth it and is deeply meaningful. So thank you for having me.
So let's delve into this, Shabbos. The first question I ask everyone is this, Shabbos, what kind of a Jew are you?
Oh, man. Well, I'll give you two answers. The first answer is bad, and the second answer is better.
Wait, bad Jew is the answer?
No. Oh. The answer is bad. My dad was a Lubavitcher. He's not anymore, but he once was. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe has a great saying that labels are for clothing. So in terms of labels and boxes, I'd like to think that I'm one of everything, which I know is very vague, but I like taking different aspects of different denominations and different ideologies. That's the bad answer. But the more specific answer is...
Wait, that's the bad answer?
That's a
good answer.
Well, it's very vague.
Okay.
The more specific answer is I'm what sociologists and rabbinic leaders would call modern Orthodox. So I grew up in an Orthodox family, went to yeshiva school system my whole life, went to yeshiva in Israel for 2 years, of course, all male, single sex. And that is a lifestyle that I practiced my whole life and conceive of myself practicing that for the rest of my life. So proudly Orthodox.
Interesting. You described that as a lifestyle.
Yeah.
Not as a belief.
Correct. So and we'll get into this in terms of how it affects being a student at Harvard and, or just being a student after October 7th. But being an Orthodox Jew is not just a religious theology. We believe that Torah encompasses all aspects of our life. So from the moment we wake up and we wash our hands three times and we say, Moda Ani, grateful are we to God for restoring our soul, to the moment we go to sleep and we confess any of the wrongdoings that we have done that day, our entire day is encompassed with a connection to God, respecting and cleaving to his commands. Our interpersonal relationships are influenced by that lifestyle. So, correct, it's not simply confined to a synagogue or to a study hall, but it's to every avenue that life encompasses. And my great-great-great-grandfather is Rabbi Samson Rafal Hirsch, who was sort of one of the forefronts of this movement of Torah im Derech Eretz, Torah with the ways of the world. And it really shows that we are not this insular, conservative segment of the Jewish population, but we're very much part of the world, but also staunchly and foremost religious.
But then there's another thing that is obviously distinctive of you as a Jew, or maybe it's distinctive of me, but obviously something that's different between the two of us. You're visibly Jewish. So for people that are not watching this, that are listening in, you have a beard, you have a black yarmulke. What is it like being visibly Jewish? Something that is not easily hidden, especially now in the United States.
Yeah, it's a great question. And in fact, post October 7th, a lot of people have asked me, why do I keep my kippah on? And number one, my name is Shabbos Kestenbaum, so it would be pretty obvious regardless. I'm kind of Jewish. But number two, it was never, not once, a consideration that I would take it off. In fact, after October 7th, I bought a bigger kippah because I've been more proud to be Jewish. But in terms of, yes, the first thing that non-Jews feel or recognize when I walk into a room, especially in an institution of higher learning, especially at a divinity school, is the kippah. And I do feel in some senses that there's a target on my back. I do feel that there's a sense of other. At the same time, though, as I mentioned, I'm really proud of it. The kippah is a wonderful symbol. It's a symbol that we are devoted to God, that God is above us, that there is a deity above us. And the fact that I can express my religious values so externally and so publicly makes me quite proud. But yes, there is this other aspect to it that sometimes makes me, I wouldn't say uncomfortable, but cognizant of I'm not like everyone else.
You know, and it's interesting you say that, because for me, even if you put aside the religious aspect, the belief of why you wear a yarmulke, the fact that you have something that ties you to all your male siblings wear a yarmulke, your dad wears a yarmulke, your grandfather wore a yarmulke, your great-grandfather, it's part of who you are. It's more than just a belief, right? Like, because theoretically, you could come to class with a baseball cap, you would fulfill all of your theistic edicts, all the biblical edicts, yet you choose to wear a yarmulke.
Yeah, I choose to wear a yarmulke each and every day. And as you mentioned, it does connect me to this broader tapestry of Jewish history, whereby as much as I say that I am this other when I enter into a classroom, for example, at the same time, there is this 3,000-year-old history. And I can look back to my familial generation, and as you quite rightly pointed out, it's my dad, it's my dad's dad, my dad's dad's dad, all the way to the giving of Torah on Mount Sinai. And it's an incredibly powerful experience to know that that is something that you are being involved in actively and voluntarily each and every single day. And as someone who, when I'm not suing Harvard, I actually study the Holocaust at Harvard, which maybe we'll get into later. But so as someone who studies the Holocaust from an academic perspective, knowing that not even 100 years ago, those who were first targeted for discrimination, hatred, and bigotry were those who were externally Jewish. Right. The fact that I can be 80 years later externally Jewish and be proud of it, and for the most part, not be a victim as a result, for the most part.
Okay, so let's delve into your experiences. So you are a graduate student. You just graduated.
Yep.
From Harvard Divinity School. October 7th happens. What's the first thing you do?
Oh, man. So I guess it actually ties in quite nicely with our conversation about being an Orthodox Jew. So October 7th was a Jewish holiday. And it was the Jewish holiday of Simchas Torah. And as a religious Jew, I'm, of course, not on my phone. And as the holiday is beginning, and of course, it's a very joyous holiday, there are these rumors that begin circulating, rumors of a terrorist attack. And I don't need to tell you, and I would imagine most of your viewers, but the reality of having a state of Israel in the 21st century is that sort of par for the course. There's a terrorist attack, and it's unfortunate, and it's sad, and we don't like it, but that's the reality of being Jewish.
We become accustomed to that happening.
Exactly. However, this time it was somewhat different. And as the hours went by, all of these rumors began circulating. There was a bombing. There was a kidnapping. No, it was a shooting. It was very unclear, except for the fact that it was something of great magnitude. And as I mentioned, Simchas Torah is a joyous Jewish holiday. So we were dancing with the Torah in the synagogue. And the room began to thin out, and there were fewer and fewer people. And this wasn't just true at the Harvard Hillel, which is the main center of Jewish life, which is where I was, but it was also down the road at Harvard Chabad, where I went to afterwards, that people's faces were turning red. Some people who I knew were crying. And it became quite clear that what was happening was something that I, as a young person, had never experienced in my life, which is Israel as an existential issue. My perception of Israel is a place where some of my siblings live, where I go for Passover, but it's a strong, vibrant democracy. You don't think of it as having these existential crises. But no, the rumors became quite clear that no, Israel itself as an entity is under attack. And so I did something I'd never done before in my life, and I used the phone on the Jewish holiday, which of course is normally forbidden. And I tried locating my siblings. I was calling my brothers and my sisters. I have a 2-year-old nephew. I have grandparents. I have aunts, uncles, cousins.
All in Israel.
All in Israel. Basically asking if they were okay or not. Where were they? Because there's this sense of dread and despair and helplessness that you're in Boston, you are hearing the most horrific of rumors, and you know that your family could potentially be in the direct line of fire. And my brother actually was in Golani. He served in the army, and now he's in Milu'im,
in reserve duty.
Yeah. So it was very, very scary. So that's how I spent my October 7th leading into October 8th. And as that was happening, unbeknownst to me at the time, we had hundreds of students at Harvard representing 34 student groups, more than 1,000 students actually, who jumped out of beds, some in their pajamas, to draft what they called an emergency statement to blame the Zionist entity and to blame Jews for the largest massacre of Jews since the Holocaust. So as Jewish students at Harvard are frantically locating their loved ones and they're crying and they don't know what to make of this new reality, our classmates, our peers, those who we once thought were our friends, are excitingly rushing to draft a statement that, as I said, blame Jews for everything that's going on.
So I want to get to that, but before we get to that, I feel like we shouldn't center on them. We should center on us. I know that you, before things started unfolding at Harvard, you went to Israel. You bought, if I'm not mistaken, a one-way ticket. That's a statement, buying a one-way ticket. What were you thinking? Why'd you go to Israel?
Yeah, I bought a one-way ticket for two reasons. The first reason was I had to be there. When Russia invaded Ukraine in February of 2022, I actually did the same thing. I couldn't go to Ukraine because all the airports were shut down, but I bought a one-way ticket to Poland, not really having a game plan, but just knowing that I wanted to help. And so I spent the first 2 weeks of the war driving across into the Ukrainian border to bring refugees back in. And I felt when it comes to Israel, where actually I do know the people on the ground and I have experience with that country and I speak the language, I have to help in some way.
Wait, I want to push on that. What do you mean? I had to be there when Russia invaded Ukraine. I felt horrible. I kept reading about it. I kept watching the footage. I did not feel like I had to be there. I didn't even to be honest. And maybe I don't know if this is something I shouldn't be proud of it, but it didn't cross my mind of I can go and help. It was something that just happens. Why did you have to be there? Why did you have to be in Israel?
I mean, I don't think I can properly articulate or really explain it. I felt the same way in the beginning of the pandemic when someone had sent me a video of Muslims in China being hoarded onto deportation trains, and they were called Uyghurs. I'd never heard that before. And I was so stunned that this was happening that I'd never heard of it before. This is an ethnic Muslim minority in China, the Uyghurs, that are being targeted for their faith. And I said, well, this doesn't make any sense. As I said, I study the Holocaust. I'm personally fascinated by the history, but also deeply moved as a Jew. And I thought to myself, we as the Jewish people know what it's like to not have allies and to not have those speaking out for us. How could it be that there's this ethnic minority being persecuted for their religion and are being sent to re-education camps? Why aren't we doing anything? So immediately I set up rallies of Jewish solidarity outside of the United Nations to, at the very least, express sympathy and solidarity with this persecuted minority. And I felt the same way in Ukraine when Russia was illegally invading a sovereign country. Ukraine also has one of the largest Jewish populations in Europe today. How could we not do anything? And I felt that way even more so with Israel, when it's almost exclusively my family in a literal sense and also in a broader religious sense. So I felt that I couldn't just stay in Boston and doom scroll and be upset, but I had to be involved in some way. So I was able to fundraise through the support of the Harvard Jewish community, and I was able to buy tactical gear, ceramic plates and vests and thermal underwear, whatever people needed. And once I landed in Ben-Gurion Airport, I had about 10 suitcases with me. Almost immediately, I was able to distribute them to soldiers who were going to bases, to families who had sons and daughters going into Gaza. And that was in my first couple hours. And then I spent the next days digging graves for soldiers. I went to hospitals just playing guitar.
Wait. You cannot bite away digging graves for soldiers.
I had to do anything to help. But I'm not saying this.
Again, you don't look like someone who's like physically. You know, I'm not a diss, but you know,
it was very difficult.
Why are you doing in Israel digging graves?
Because someone had to do it, and I was in a position to help, and that's what I felt that I had to do. And the other part of it, and this is definitely going to bring me down, is I just couldn't stand to be at Harvard for one more day. So there's this duality. There's the feeling of helplessness, and I want to be involved and help my brethren. And then there's other feeling of what is happening in my own community back in Boston is so horrific that they are championing, glorifying, and celebrating the murder of Jewish people. I physically couldn't be in those classrooms and in those settings. So it was twofold. And as I said, yeah, I just spent days trying to be as much of a help as I could. And the difference I made is negligible. I'm not one of those heroes who stayed for weeks and months and raised millions of dollars. I did in my own small capacity what I was able to do. But as you mentioned, I bought a one-way ticket. The plan was not to go back to Harvard. I didn't want to go back. I couldn't go back. Inevitably, I did, but...
I wouldn't call your what you did negligible.
Oh, thanks.
You can call it. I won't. But it sounds so that you were pulled in the direction of Israel, but you were also pushed out of Boston, of Harvard. When did you decide to go back to school, go back to Boston, go back to Harvard?
It was a very difficult decision. I was quoted in the foreword a couple of days after October 7th, where they wanted to get a feel of how Jewish students were thinking and grappling with the issue. And I said that for my own mental sanity, I couldn't spend one more day at Harvard University, and it was much better for me to be in an active war zone in the Middle East. So after a couple of days of helping, and after a couple of days of being with my family and realizing that they were okay, and that there was a limit to what I could mentally and emotionally do, I realized two things. I realized, number one, I had sort of fulfilled the immediate mission that I had set out for myself in Israel. And number two, and it's quite unfortunate because it's still ongoing, I felt that there weren't enough people speaking out on behalf of the Jewish community at Harvard, which is really telling. You know, the active war in the Middle East, the soldiers were covered for the most part. And the Jews had a sense of solidarity and camaraderie and purpose.
And agency.
And agency, exactly. And at Harvard, we were just getting pummeled each and every day. Each day was worse than the last. And just to give you a silly anecdote, I was involved, before they kicked me out, I was involved in a number of WhatsApp groups of Harvard students. And I remember just scrolling every single day to see another long live the Intifada rally, you know, this Sunday, 4 p.m., long live the revolution rally. This is like October 10th, 11th, 12th.
And these are fellow students of yours at the Divinity School.
I know their names.
So tell me, what kind of people go to Divinity School?
that's the question.
You know, if you ask me before I knew you, before I've heard of all of this, I would say, well, the best kind of people, the best Christians, Muslims, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, like everyone who wants to be a spiritual leader, either of a congregation or a parish or politically, but anyone who is spiritual and wants to lead people in spirituality is likely to end up at a divinity school.
One would have hoped.
How are we seeing these kind of messages 3 days after the massacre, while there are still terrorists in Israel trying to kill as many Jews? How are we seeing these kind of messages?
Well, first of all, it wasn't even just 3 days. It was also the night of the massacre, where a disproportionate amount of these student groups that had signed on to this letter blaming Jews for the largest massacre of Jews were actually from the Divinity School. And to answer your question, we have to look more broadly at the state of higher education and academia in the United States, which you know more than I is fundamentally broken. These are students who are given an intellectual justification and a rationale in the classroom and through the curriculum to champion the causes of the alleged oppressed. And when the average American turns on their television set and they see the dichotomy between the white Israeli and the brown or black Palestinian, which of course we know is more nuanced and it's more complex than that, rightly or wrongly, we have a tendency to automatically sympathize with those who we deem as oppressed. And when my classmates and my professors, when they looked at the October 7th massacre and the horrific and unjustified attack of Hamas, the immediate reaction was, well, we have to contextualize this, we have to rationalize it. And in fact, the Religion and Public Life Department at Harvard Divinity School, they released their own statement on October 10th. And the statement began by saying, in order to understand October 7th, we have to go back 75 years. No mention of the word Hamas, no mention of the word Jews, no condemnation, just talking about apartheid, settler colonialism, settlements.
Why 75
That was their
years?
Response, because you have to go back to the original sin. The original sin is Israel. It will always go back to that. And this is not hyperbole or exaggeration.
But it's I'm going to push on that. You said it's the religious and...
The Religion and Public Life Department.
Religion and Public Life, like... If you're a religion and public life office in a divinity school, why not go 3,000 years? October 7th, you need to go 3,000 years back.
I couldn't agree with you more. What's so convenient about Harvard Divinity School is history starts whenever it's convenient. So in this case, it's 75 years. Mm. But going back before then, it's not relevant to the narrative. And in fact, it's actually counter to the narrative, so they don't do it. And again, it's not an exaggeration. I'm not trying to score ideological points. I am saying this as someone who has direct experience in the classroom. I spent my first full year at Harvard, a year before October 7th, in these spaces deliberately. I wanted to show my classmates and my professors that I am not the insular, conservative, Orthodox Jew that they must surmise that I am. So I took classes literally called Religion, Nationalism, and Settler Colonialism, the Case of Israel-Palestine. I applied for a class called Narratives in Displacement, the Case of Israel Palestine. I went with Jewish Voices for Peace to do an abolitionist religious ceremony where we washed ourselves of the sins of apartheid. I did all that, not because I necessarily believed in it, but because I wanted to show that I'm intellectually curious and I can engage with ideas that are foreign or alien to me. So I can tell you, as a matter of fact, that they are taught absolutely anti-Western and anti-Semitic propaganda. There was one week of our course that was literally titled The Holocaust and the Ongoing Nakba, which tries to equate not only the treatment of Palestinians by Israelis to the treatment of Jews by Germans, but also Nazi Germany, but also makes the point that the Jewish response to the Holocaust has been ultra defensive. The only way we know how to defend our civilization and our rights is to act as the oppressors that we had experienced 80 years ago. This was being taught in the classroom.
And at Harvard. This is not a community college where anyone can do whatever they want. This is Harvard, supposedly like the place that should be, you know, the greatest minds, there's some structure. What strikes me is not so much the content. Maybe it should strike me. Maybe I've become desensitized. But the volume, like, how many courses are there about Israel-Palestine in the divinity school? We're one of the smallest religions, you know, ethnic groups in the world. It's the smallest area. Why are they obsessed with the topic?
I and a friend have actually tracked, in the 2 years that I've been at Harvard, have tracked the amount of events on Israel-Palestine just coming from the Religion and Public Life Department at Harvard Divinity School. And it's more than 40 events. And all of them paint
Israel... In 2 years?
In 2 years. And all of them, without exception, paint Israel in the same negative light of settler colonialism, apartheid, and genocide. They were claiming genocide pre-October 7th,
Just to put that in context for people... 40 events in 2 years, if we take off the 2.5 months of summer, averages in about an event every other week.
Yeah.
Bashing Israel.
That sounds about right. Yep.
So
we have a Google Doc where we have literally have a running list of all of the events. And some of the events that are co-sponsored, of course, by the Center for Middle Eastern Studies feature people who are notoriously anti-Semitic. So Nora Ericott, who is under investigation in New Jersey for anti-Semitism, literally appeared on a panel with a senior Hamas commander who claimed that we will make October 7th a million more times. And when we told the Religion and Public Life Department, and when we told the Center for Middle Eastern Studies, and when we told Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion, DEI, offices, that this is a woman who appears on panels with Hamas members, we got one response from DEI saying, don't worry because the event isn't mandatory. That's shocking. And it's inexcusable, and it is objectively the case that no other minority group would have to go through such bureaucratic hurdles to be heard.
So when did you start fighting back?
Well, it depends how you define fighting back. I began what I call just speaking out. I did that pretty quickly. The moment I got back to Harvard, essentially, I started speaking out in my classes. I started speaking out for the first time on social media, which I was very new to and still very new to. I still don't know quite how to use it. And
both of us have no idea what we're doing, but doing it.
But it's a powerful platform. You know, social media can have the potential to reach millions of people. So I started doing that quite quickly because I felt like if you're screaming at the top of your lungs and no one is listening, what else are you meant to do? So I tried resorting to as many drastic tactics as I could think of. I started contacting media outlets saying, you should really report on what's happening at Harvard because it is so unbelievable that a distinctly American institution is backsliding into the 17th century. Their depictions and conceptions of Jews and Judaism is so horrifically anti-Semitic. People need to understand what's happening. And so I started speaking out, as I said, quite quickly. And thank God, really, thank God, people began to notice. And I was given, very fortunately, a platform to express what was happening, to be a voice for those who either couldn't speak for themselves or didn't want to speak for themselves. We, of course, got involved in litigation, which we'll talk about. And I haven't stopped, and I'm not going to stop.
So let's talk about the lawsuit. Let's talk. When did you decide to shift gears or maybe add another tactic, which is not just speaking out, not just media, but let's take Harvard not just to the court of public opinion, but also to the court of law?
So it's a good question, and I would preface my answer by simply saying, I don't want to do this. Not that I didn't want to do this. I still don't want to do it.
Explain what is
this. Yeah, filing a lawsuit against your university, and in particular Harvard University, which is such an iconic institution in the American imagination, it's daunting, it's intimidating, but we felt that we had no other option. So in the beginning, very early on, when Claudine Gay was still the president of Harvard University, we made a tactical decision that we wanted to work with the administration as much as possible.
I should say for people that maybe don't remember or not exactly sure, Claudine Gay is one of the three presidents who in December in front of Congress, when asked whether calling for the genocide of the Jews is acceptable at Harvard, she said, it depends.
Yeah, depends on the context. Exactly. So we decided we can and we should work with them. But very quickly, it was apparent that that would not be possible. Harvard quite literally just didn't answer the phone. They wouldn't return our emails. They really did not engage in any
Harvard
meaningful...
Harvard is an organization. Harvard as, who at Harvard?
Right.
What offices?
Harvard as a university has DEI offices, not just one, but most schools. Harvard is comprised of 13 schools. The largest is the college, the undergrad, and then they also have graduate schools. So I'm at the Divinity School, there's the law school, the medical school, the business school. Most schools, I actually think all schools, have their own DEI offices. And then there's also the Harvard Corporation, which is sort of like the Board of Trustees. And then you have the university president, which was Claudine Gay. Now it's Alan Garber. You have the provost, who at the time was Alan Garber. So we were emailing the DEI offices. We were emailing Claudine Gay, CCing Alan Garber, trying to make meetings, trying to get these appointments, trying to tell them what it was like being Jewish at Harvard day to day. And we were rebuffed to this day.
Did you get any response?
No.
Not even, thank you for your email. You know, your call is number 215 line, please hold.
Alan Garber and Claudine Gay have not once responded to a single email or phone call I've ever sent. Way before we filed the lawsuit.
That is incredible. You know what? Minu Shafiq has never responded to any of my emails, the president of Columbia.
There you
Maybe
go.
Maybe they're emailing each other and they're too busy.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So the lawsuit unfortunately became necessary because we didn't know what else to do. We had to get the university's attention, but more fundamentally, we had to protect Jewish students. So I was connected with Kaswitz Benson Torres, which is an aggressive corporate litigation firm in New York.
I wouldn't say aggressive, I'd say assertive.
So assertive, yes, very assertive. And they've been remarkable every step of the way. They're so concerned and so besides themselves that this is a reality for Jewish students. But a point I want to make, and this is really crucial, is I told my lawyers, way before we actually filed the lawsuit in January, I said if Harvard were to change course, if they were to correct themselves and implement policies to counter anti-Semitism, if Jews did not have this unequal treatment, then I wouldn't file the lawsuit. Because as I predicated my answer on, I didn't want to do this. But it became quickly clear that Harvard had no interest in rectifying the situation. So we were forced into a corner. We were forced into a position we didn't want to be in. And we filed the lawsuit in January, arguing, among other things, that there have been gross violations of Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which forbids public institutions that receive federal funding from discriminating against those with national origin. Judaism is not just a religion, it's also an ethnicity. And we feel, as the evidence shows and as our testimony has shown, that we have been discriminated against and we have been treated categorically different than any other minority group.
Put yourself in the shoes of a higher up Harvard administrator, maybe even the president. You said they are unwilling to rectify the situation. Why do you think that is? What's going on in Vermont? If you can, maybe
it's,
you can't.
It's so funny because after 8 months of answering questions and going on talks and testifying in front of Congress, that is the one question I've still never been able to answer. Why have they been unable, or at this point unwilling, to rectify the situation? What are they so scared of? Where is the leadership? I have my suspicions, I have speculations, but the short answer is I don't know, because it's so irrational. It doesn't make sense. Because it's not just that there are Jewish students who feel threatened and are threatened, but those on the ideological adversaries are students who do not support the university, do not support Western liberalism, do not support our values. So why is it that Harvard and Columbia and Penn, why is it they've been so unable to condemn this faction? Why have they given in to them every step of the way? And they're not even a majority. They're just a very loud, angry, aggressive minority. And they'll interrupt classrooms and they'll set up tents and they'll call for an intifada. But they're children, and Harvard should treat them as the children that they are, but they just don't. And I don't know. I think there's
they're,
an element.
They're actually disagree with you. Yeah. I don't see them as children. They are adults. They are coddled as children, but they are, if they break the law, they are of adult age and they should go to jail.
Oh, I certainly.
If they make money, they should pay taxes. And if there is a draft, they will be drafted. Well, their parents will pay for them not to be drafted. Right. But they are not children.
I certainly agree that they have agency and they are relatively rational actors. When I say that they're children, I'm mostly referring to their tactics. When they don't get their way, they will literally yell and scream. That's what they do. And the moment there is a whiff of accountability or discipline, they will claim oppression. They will claim that this is injustice or a gross characterization of justice. So their actions are childlike. And this underscores how fundamentally disastrous the response of Harvard has been, because they've been unable to contend with these adults, kids, these aggressors. And I don't know why. I think an element of it is they really are scared, because they have, as you use the right term, they've coddled for a generation young American students to believe that the world is a binary of oppressor and oppressed. And Jews, of course, have the misfortune of being characterized as white. And we are, whether it was 40 babies beheaded or 40,000 babies beheaded on October 7th, we are the oppressors. So no amount of harm can possibly be done to us, because it all falls through that prism. And they, these aggressors, they are universally oppressed. And so if they interrupt the classroom, if they harass a student, if they set up a surveillance system on campus to monitor Jews on their way to class, which is what they did at Harvard, that's okay, because they have been wronged. Some societal harm has befallen them. And Harvard has amplified that message, that ideology. And for them to really crack down on these students would imply that they were wrong to have coddled them. That's my theory.
How do you stay so calm? How do you, and I mean it really honestly, like, you have been in the thick of it. And if I'm not mistaken, you're probably the only person, you've been speaking in this in the first person plural, but you've been the only person speaking up from Harvard. I have seen videos of you being followed by pro-Hamas protesters on campus. Why are you not pissed?
I definitely am pissed. I tried being angry in the beginning, and I realized it wasn't getting me anywhere. I would just as easily like to throw my head against the wall and scream and say, what the hell is happening? How did we get to this situation? But it's not going to serve a purpose. It's not going to advance our agenda. I'm angry every single day. For 8 months, I have woken up with just a sense of dread of how can today be worse than it was yesterday. And lo and behold, Harvard finds a way. Yeah. But I do get
it's a race between Harvard and Columbia. I think it's an Ivy League race where we're trying to outdo each other.
I always say this is the one instance where Columbia outranks Harvard. In terms of anti-Semitism, you guys are number one. But I do get a sense of solace and certainly a sense of strength from people like Rachel Goldberg-Poland, who's the mother of Hesh, who's one of the captives in Gaza.
Who's an American citizen.
Who's an American citizen. And of course, every time we put his poster up at Harvard, it's torn down. But I digress. I mean, she is unbelievable. She is someone who's quite literally facing issues of life and death every single day. And she's been able to meet with the president and go to Congress and speak to media. And she is so poised and dignified. She has really been a role model to me. So yeah, I want to be angry and I want to cry. And I maybe shouldn't say this on camera, but there are some days where I have cried. It has been an awful, awful 8 months. I'm on medication for depression and anxiety. And
you're not alone. I am too.
Oh, there we go. But as I said, I want to create change. I don't want any Jewish student to have to go through what I and other Jewish students have been going through. And me crying and getting pissed, unfortunately, isn't going to help it. As much as it will feel good, it's just not going to help.
But you've also paid a personal price. I've heard you tell this story at the Lincoln Center Synagogue. And when it was time for me to speak, my immediate reaction, I might have even said it out loud, was, no, let him keep talking. Tell me again the story of the staff member.
Yeah, this one is particularly difficult. So the night before the spring semester was to begin, I was walking through Harvard Yard and found that all of our posters were defaced, which, as I said, is par for the course.
Defaced being what?
Meaning people had written, Jews did 9/11, Jews are friends with Jeffrey Epstein, on Kfir Bibas, who's now the 1.5-year-old child being held in Gaza by Hamas. The vandal had written, his head is still on, where's the evidence? So that was difficult to see. That's number one.
Yeah.
Of course, I immediately notify DEI and the president and everyone, no response. I go on Fox News. 3 hours later, there's a response. So I get an email the next morning from a staff member who I'd never heard of, had never met, did not know existed, admitting that he had vandalized the posters and he had seen my interview at Fox News calling whoever this vandal was an anti-Semite. And he claimed that he's not an anti-Semite. He just wants to see something along the lines of the obliteration of the state of Israel. And then the kicker was...
Let's pause there for a second before you continue. You say he claimed. He would say, no, I'm not an anti-Semite. I just want the obliteration of the state of Israel.
Yeah, that's a rational response and normalized rhetoric at Harvard, where students say, no, I don't hate Jews. I just think that they should not exist from the river to the sea. And then when you ask them a follow-up is, where should they go? Well, it's not my problem. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's very easy to concoct an imaginary scenario where there's this peaceful democratic state of Palestine that Jews and Arabs can coexist peacefully. But as I said, that's not realistic. That's not based in a reality. That's based in the ivory tower, morally comprised academia, where you can have these sorts of discussions. But yeah, most of my classmates will tell you with a straight face that it is not anti-Semitic to say that the state of Israel shouldn't exist. Anyways, so he claimed he's not anti-Jewish. He just doesn't believe in the state of Israel to exist. And the kicker was he then challenged me to debate him as to whether Jews were involved in 9/11 or not. This is a staff member at Harvard who had emailed me from his official Harvard email. I was I don't even want to say I was stunned. I don't even know how to react to that. It was so unlike anything I could have ever imagined was possible, that this was the reality I was experiencing. So I didn't know how to react, and I kind of didn't react. I, of course, didn't respond to him. I don't even think I reported it to anyone. I was just so shocked that this was happening.
And how long was this staff member at Harvard?
So he's a Harvard College graduate, and he's been working at Harvard for 26 years. And in fact, I mean, at the risk of promoting him, but you could go on his social media, and his handle has been the same handle for years now, is the 9/11 guy, where he espouses 9/11 conspiracies that Jews were behind the 9/11 terror attacks. He's been doing this for years, and he's been working for Harvard for 26 years.
And this is a staff member.
This is a staff member. He's getting paid.
Do you know what the role is?
Yeah, East Asian Language and Civilizations. He works for their department. So I get this email from him. I don't respond. And then later that night, I'm working and I get frantic calls from friends. And they say, have you seen his social media? And I said, no. And he sent me a video. And it's of him waving a machete, saying that he wants to fight. And he has this grand plan.
To fight who?
To fight me. Then he has pictures of Alan Dershowitz and Elena Kagan, who's on the Supreme Court. He's saying that he wants to fight, and he has some sort of plan. And I call my lawyers and say, what the hell do I do with this? And they said, go inside, lock your doors, and we're going to get you some security. So I had private armed security outside my house for a week. I have emailed and had emailed Harvard after that video. That freaked me out. So I emailed Harvard and called, and I filed police reports. To this day, this happened 4 or 5 months ago. To this day, Harvard has not once acknowledged to me that they have received any of my emails. They haven't told me what his employment status is. They haven't told me if he has access to campus. They haven't told me if he has access to my address, because as a Harvard student, I'm in the database. Not once have they acknowledged that this happened. The only reason I know that he was fired is because he posted about it on his own social media. And that only happened 3 months after the fact, after I went in front of Congress to talk about it on live TV.
At the end of the semester.
Yeah.
So when the semester ends, he was let go. I wouldn't call that being fired.
Well, you know, from what I understand, it doesn't work there anymore.
So, okay, so...
Can we just appreciate... irrational.
No, a Jewish student emails the university about a staff member who's been there for 26 years with making a video of himself with a machete, threatening that specific student, and also threatening prominent Jewish individuals in the United States. Harvard doesn't even say, thank you, we received your email.
That is correct. And now you know why we had to file a lawsuit. Because this has been normalized. That this is a procedure. This is part and parcel about being a Jewish student on a college campus. When something of this magnitude happens, there is literally no response. That is so un-American. That is so dangerous. That is so infected with anti-Semitism. I mean, the only word I can really express is it's irrational. It doesn't make sense that you can have a student from a minority group saying that you have an employee of 26 years who has been espousing 9/11 conspiracies for decades or two decades, who is now posting videos of him and a machete. And by the way, about a month after, he posted on Twitter that he had bought the domain ShabbosKestenbaum.com, which he has, and he's going to write about me and expose me for who I really am. And then he wrote that he's coming after me and he's coming for more than blood, prevent him from getting what he wants. And there's no response, except for when he posts on his own social media that he was fired, and supposedly Harvard has admitted in court to my lawyers that we let him go. That is dangerous. That's bad. That is really, really bad. And let me just make one last point. When I go across the country and I talk about whether Jews should be on the Ivy League campuses and higher education, I have to say that story because parents and the kids more specifically need to understand the dangers and the risks that they are potentially exposing themselves to. And it's not like I really did anything wrong. You know, this is what another point I always try to make. I'm very proud of the lawsuit we filed because it shows that we as the Jewish community are proud of our values. We're proud of the fact that we comply with law enforcement enforcement, for example. We get permits for the few times we protest. We comply with the university. We want to have friends and dialogue and debate. We have nothing to apologize
for. You waved the Israeli flag and the American exactly. flag. You sing Hatikva and the Star-Spangled
exactly. We're proud
banner.
Americans, you know? But at some point, we have to acknowledge that if these universities just don't want us, which by the last 8 months, it's quite clear they don't, then why are we so insistent that, no, we're still going to go? And I think we should still go. But at this point, it's I don't have the right words anymore. It's depressing. It's demoralizing. It's scary. It's dangerous. But it's also normalized.
How old are you?
25.
25. I'm assuming that there will be people hearing your story who have kids that are 18-year-old and have worked for asses off to get to a great school. They got great grades. They go to Harvard. They major in Near Eastern studies. They might interact with someone like that. Now, I am not, there are always going to be crazies out there. I'm not, that is not my concern. My concern is the fact that the university never even acknowledged that the problem exists. How could a mom and a dad who are already worried about their kids leaving home for the first time, they're worried about them drinking, they're worried about them, you know, getting their rent in time, are they eating enough, are they getting exercise? How can a Jewish mom and a Jewish dad sleep soundly at night when they know that Columbia University, that Harvard University, that Penn University are so, if not anti-Semitic, been so indifferent to anti-Semitism?
I wish I had a good answer for you. And by the way, we've only been talking about my experience and your experience, but we haven't amplified the stories of other students at Harvard, at least, who've also been exposed to physical threats, like the Jew who was spat on while he was wearing a kippah, or the Israeli student who was asked to leave class because his nationality made other classmates uncomfortable, or the other Jewish student who was followed home to her dorm in the middle of the night by one of the protesters. So in terms of your question, I don't know. I wish I had a better answer. And it's also critical to realize that we, as the Jewish students at Harvard and across college campuses, we're not advocating for relatively revolutionary ideals. We're simply asking to be treated not differently, but equally. That's a pretty basic baseline standard, and we haven't even gotten that. So in terms of these parents, I don't know what to tell them. I can certainly tell them that we need young people, we need their kids to be strong, passionate fighters, to be believers, not just in Western liberalism, but also in Zionism. That should not be a dirty word. So they should inculcate a passion for truth and a passion for activism. But yes, there's also this dangerous element of the societies and the institutions that they're placing their kids in really don't want them or are indifferent.
So prediction is a fool's game, but where do you think the lawsuit is going? Whatever you can say, and I know you
can't
tell.
No, I hope I can say a lot. I'll put it this way. Harvard currently is in court trying for now the third time to dismiss our lawsuit with prejudice, meaning not only would our lawsuit alleging pervasive and systemic anti-Semitism be tossed out, but the Jewish students would not be able to address their grievances over anti-Semitism through a court of law ever again. So when Harvard
tells you that you cannot drop that bomb.
And they're trying to dismiss our motion. Excuse me. They're trying to dismiss our lawsuit with prejudice.
What does that mean with prejudice? So
as in our complaints are so frivolous, they're so without merit, that not only should it be thrown away, but these students should not be able to come back with a similar claim again.
Because it's frivolous to complain
exactly.
about anti-Semitism.
So when Harvard has their cronies and their spokespeople go out into the public and give these statements saying we're so concerned about anti-Semitism and we just want our Jewish students to know how valued they are, I don't know if I'm allowed to, can I curse? Can I say a bad word?
Please.
That is such total and utter bullshit, because they are literally fighting in court to make sure that Jewish students at Harvard cannot receive any equity, equality, justice, or fairness through a court of law. They're actively trying to silence our voices. So the next time you are a parent and you're at a college night for your student and there's a Harvard admissions representative and they tell you, yeah, we are really taking this issue seriously, ask them then, why are you trying to dismiss the only lawsuit brought by Jewish students against your university? Ask them why they haven't implemented a literal single policy since October 7th to combat anti-Semitism. Ask them why there's no mandatory Title IX training as it pertains to anti-Semitism, even though there's training against fat phobia, against transphobia, against homophobia. Ask them why anti-Semitism isn't included,
which are all important.
It's not either or. Exactly. I mean, and this is also true of DEI. I'm not necessarily against the ideals of diversity, equity, and inclusion. I'm arguing that if you are going to have that system, rightly or wrongly, you have to include Jews as part of that system. So you should ask Harvard all of these questions, and they will not be able to give you an answer. Why? Because the reality is they haven't done anything, they haven't said anything, and they don't care about us. If they cared about us, people like Alan Garber or Claudine Gay at the time would have come down and spoken to us, not the pre-selected students who are going to say what they've told them to say. And this is also true if you look at their anti-Semitism task force, which is the second iteration of a previously failed task force of which the most respected member, David Wolpe, resigned from.
Rabbi David Wolpe.
Yeah. So, I mean, now I really am getting pissed off.
Good, but you should be. I mean, I don't understand how we're not all pissed off all the time.
The situation is just so outrageous. And I guess I'll sort of conclude this tirade by saying that the best thing the Jewish community can do is amplify the voices of students, because I don't think they are properly outraged. I don't think they're properly informed. They'll read something, they'll hear from their friend's friend who's in one of the universities, but you have to hear it directly from the students who are experiencing unimaginable hatred, bigotry, and discrimination, and obstacles from their own university to receive that equity and justice. So amplify those voices of students. Reach out to them. Ask them to speak at your dinner and your conference and your convention. Hear from them, because their stories are so heartbreaking.
It's, you know, even though I know all of this, or most of it, I don't know all the details that you just shared, but I know I've been living this at Columbia, and I've been experiencing it at Harvard and Penn and Stanford and UC Santa Barbara and Berkeley and all those places, it still shocks me every time. I want to ask you a maybe more personal question, and maybe this is like, you know, you said that this rabid anti-Semite has bought the ShabbosKasimim.com and he's going to write your story. So here's a story about you. You used to be an organizer for Bernie Sanders.
Yep. Don't hold it against me.
No, I want to know about that, and I want to know, how does it feel? Because people see you, there's like an Orthodox Jew, beard, black yarmulke, typically, obviously assume, okay, he's definitely right-wing, probably MAGA. They see you in Fox and Friends, they see you in Fox News, right? Not knowing that you're nothing of those things.
Well, first of all, if MSNBC wanted to invite me, I am all open for that as well. But yes,
they never invited me.
It's me only
neither.
Fox.
Who are they having on? Like,
they're having, I'll tell you who they're having. They're having, 4 weeks ago, they had a speaker who was a Harvard student who graduated from the Kennedy School, who had his entire speech about the genocide and apartheid and Harvard's racist because they're silencing black and brown voices. They had him on to talk about the genocide and how Israel's an apartheid state. He was on. But I don't think they've really invited, I don't, to the best of my knowledge, I don't think they've had a Jewish student at Harvard come on MSNBC to talk about anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. I'm happy to be proven wrong, but I don't think they have. Mm-hmm. So yes, I am happy to compare my progressive credentials any day of the week. I voted for Bernie Sanders twice. I volunteered for Jamal Bowman and voted for him.
For Jamal Bowman,
a member of the squad.
You're going to get me canceled.
Yeah. Well, I'm doing repentance. So I've spoken at some fundraisers for his Democratic opponent, George Latimer, who will be elected 100%. George is a great guy and he'll win. But yeah, I was at the 2016 Democratic Convention. I actually had an Israeli flag at the Democratic Convention. I was called a terrorist sympathizer. I was 17 at the time. So marching with Black Lives Matter, marching with the LGBTQ+ community, posting on social media about how Roe v. Wade was a terrible Supreme Court precedent. I'm a liberal. Oh, I registered to vote as a Democrat the day I turned 18. I am a through and through liberal, bar none. All of that was true on up until October 6th. On October 7th, there began a political trajectory that I am still on, a ideological evolution of sorts. I'm very what you would probably call politically homeless. The 2024 election will be very difficult for me.
As it will be, I believe, for many, many Jews.
Yeah. I mean, that's actually given me solace, knowing that there are lots of other Jews in my boat. But the Democratic Party, which always had far-left elements that I was willing to ignore, I was cognizant of it, but I didn't think it posed much of a threat. I am now much more not only aware of it, but am aware of its impact on policy, on legislation, on national rhetoric. So it's difficult for me to ally myself with those movements and with those people ever again. And while, as I said, I still haven't figured out exactly where I fit politically, I do know that my politics have shifted considerably. I'm a lot more focused on a strong foreign policy and national security, the need to reform higher education, the need to rid ourselves of diversity, equity, and inclusion standards and statements. These are things that I didn't really believe in before, but have been reinforced post-October 7th.
So what's next for you? What's next for Shabbos?
Well, we're definitely going to keep on fighting. We have, as you said, the court of law, but also the court of public opinion. We obviously have the lawsuit, but just getting the public aware and outraged is critical. I want to be a voice of and for the Jewish community in any capacity, in all the ways I can, for as long as I can. I think what that probably looks like is entering politics in some form, whether that's elected office or public policy or political advocacy. I definitely have been fortunate to be given a platform. As small as it is, it's still a platform, and I want to not only capitalize on that, but bring about the change that I think is really, really needed. And it's unfortunate that it took October 7th for the Jewish community to wake up and for there to be this emergence of young leaders. I don't mean me. I mean the Tessas and the Elis and the Edens. But I want to cast my lot with them.
Tessa Wexler, Eli Tzvias,
yes.
Eden Yediger.
Yes, sorry. From UCLA, many, many Santa others. Barbara, and Columbia.
Eyal Jacoby.
Yep, Eyal from Penn.
Yeah.
So I'm very privileged to be part of that network and community.
You're our next Joe Lieberman.
Well, he was a bit more to the right. So maybe Joe Lieberman a bit more to the left, but yeah, we'll see.
Do you have any book or movie recommendations for people who want to educate themselves about Israel, about Jewish life, about Jewish civil rights, about how Jews fight back?
Wow, that's a really good question, actually. I do.
By the way, there's nothing professors love more than hearing that's a really good question.
Okay, it is a good question.
So for anyone listening who's going to school, anytime a professor asks you a question, you say that's a really, really good question.
There actually is one. So something we didn't mention is I go to Poland a lot. I'm actually going there next week. I've been there probably 25 times at this point. And there's one film in particular called Son of Saul, which is about the Sonderkommando in Auschwitz. The Sonderkommando were in charge of disposing the bodies of Jewish inmates at Auschwitz.
Yes, and specifically, they would take them out of the gas chambers and put them into the crematoriums.
Exactly. Yeah. They were sort of known as these dead men walking because every 3 or 4 months, they themselves would be killed, so there would be no surviving witnesses, and a new transport would be the new Sonderkommandos. It's historical fiction, so the part that I'm really adamant that people watch is it talks about the real life revolt of the Sonderkommando in Auschwitz. They blew up one of the crematoria and some of them were able to escape. They were eventually caught by the Nazis, but they were able to break the barbed wires of Auschwitz. Now, why do I say that this is such an important movie to watch post October 7th is because the date at which the Sonderkommando started their revolt was October 7th, 1944. And I don't know what the significance is of that. I'm not a rabbi. I'm not a motivational speaker. But there's something about October 7th, 1944, being the day in which the Jews stopped being defined by their oppressors and started speaking up for themselves and resisted through strength, resisted those who were demarcating Jews for the slaughterhouse. That is a powerful thing that I don't think a lot of people have made a connection to. The fact that one of the most pivotal dates in all of Jewish history was not just October 7th of 2023, but October 7th, 1944. And it's a story, yes, of tragedy and despair, but also hope, bravery, and sacrifice. And in order to understand the Jewish story today, and I might be biased because I study this, but you have to understand the experience of the Jews from 1934 to 1945. We should not be defined by our enemies and our oppressors and those who want to curse us and blot us out, but it is an important part in defining who we are today.
In two sentences, why do you go to Poland so much?
Two reasons. One, as I said, academically, this is where I do a lot of my research. It's fascinating seeing those places. And then on a deeper level, number two, is religiously and spiritually, it is incredibly meaningful to go to places that Jews have seldom visited since the war, places like the grave of the Kutzker Rebbe, Menachem Mendel Morgenstern, where it is just me and him amongst the trees, and being able to repair Jewish cemeteries and meet Holocaust survivors who are still living in Poland and hearing their stories and touching places that have seen such not only horrific sites of slaughter and massacre, but also 1,000 years of Jewish life. I find it so deeply powerful and meaningful. And Poland should be defined, yes, by the Holocaust, but also by a Jewish civilization that had flourished there and had given so much life and energy to that place for so long.
And what are you going to be doing in this next visit?
I will actually be bike riding 60 miles from Auschwitz-Birkenau to the Jewish Community Center of Krakow with a 95-year-old Auschwitz survivor, Bernard.
Bernard what?
Bernard Offen. You should all look him up, his story. He's a champion, not just for the Jewish people, but at the Jewish Community Center in Krakow, which is led by the incredible Jonathan Ornstein. And they have rebuilt Jewish life in Krakow. And it is incredible to walk through their doors. And on the one floor, you have the senior club where you have Auschwitz survivors. And across the room, you have Ukrainian refugees going into their free daily shop where they can get their necessities. And on the top floor, you have the first preschool, Jewish preschool since the Holocaust. And that to me, which is embodied by the Jewish Community Center in Krakow, the JCC, is what it means to be Jewish. We are not defined by our oppression. We are not defined by the terrible experiences that we have had. You know, Krakow is an hour drive from Auschwitz, and there's so much life, and I want to be a part of that. And that's one of the things that have also given me so much comfort.
I visited Poland and the ghettos and the concentration camps and the death camps when I was 17, and I remember telling myself, that's it, never coming to Poland ever again. But now I kind of want to go with you.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's do it. And we should bring college students, Jewish and non-Jewish, and show them that, yes, the Holocaust happened and it's important you know the history, and then we rebuilt. And we should have them meet with Bernard and have them meet with the kids and the Jewish kids in Krakow to show that Jewish life continues. And as terrible as this year has been, it has been a terrible year that will go down in the history books. This is not the end of our story. This is simply a chapter, and we are the authors of our own destiny, and we will just continue to write.
And that's how you fight back.
All
right, so I want to finish with something I've been calling a Jewish lightning round.
Okay.
A series of questions. There's no right or wrong answer. You just give me the first answer that comes to mind. You get one pass, and I get to choose if you get that pass.
Okay. Shabbos. I'm nervous. Yeah.
What is one thing people don't know about you?
Oh, my God. I'm not that interested. I play ukulele.
Mm-hmm. What is one thing people don't know about the Jews?
Oh, that's a good one. One thing people don't know about the Jews is we come in all backgrounds, races, ethnicities, identities, and languages.
What is your favorite curse? Hebrew, English, Yiddish, whatever.
I do say bullshit and horseshit a lot. But my campers might be watching this, so if they are watching this, don't say those words. They're not good.
Campers where?
In Moshava.
Okay. When was the last time you cried?
A couple weeks ago, when things were very tough.
If you could have any person over for Shabbat dinner from any moment in history, who would that be?
Menachem Mendel Morgenstern, the Kutzker Rebbe. That one was easy. He's the most fascinating figure in Hasidic history, and he does not get enough attention.
Is there a book about him that I can read?
There's a couple, yes. Quest for Authenticity, Passion for Truth, in Hebrew, Snabo Er B'Kutsk, and there, if you speak Yiddish, Kutsk.
Okay. What's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Hanukkah. My birthday's on Hanukkah, and I do like donuts, and it's everything that I value, light over darkness, goodness over hate.
What's your least favorite Jewish holiday?
Pass.
Passover?
No, well played.
No, I'll pass. When do you feel safest?
Oh, that's a good question. When do I feel safest? When I'm with my mom. I like my mom.
I actually met your parents.
Oh, you did?
In the March for the Hostages in Center Park. Your dad has your eyes and smile. When do you feel least safe?
Harvard University. That was easy.
What gives you hope?
Other Jewish students who have been through a hell of a lot worse than I have and continue to persevere and to speak so eloquently and articulate exactly not only the problems we're facing, but the solutions we need to address them.
Mm. Finally, every episode, I urge the listeners to donate to one charity that does good in Israel or across the Jewish diaspora. Where would you want people to donate to this week?
The Jewish Community Center of Krakow. As I said earlier, the fact that we can rebuild Jewish life less than an hour away from Auschwitz-Birkenau is a testament to the power of Judaism, of the Jewish people, and a testament to those who've made the Jewish Community Center so successful, like Jonathan Ornstein. And they take care of anyone from the ages of 9 months to 99. And they're an incredible organization. Just down the road is Chabad of Krakow. And what they have been able to do in Poland is nothing short of miraculous. So please support their efforts.
That's amazing. Shabbos, where can people find you?
Oh, like social media?
Yeah, don't give out your address. Don't give out your address.
Where do I live? Because the machete guy knows where I live. I don't know if I... On Instagram, I'm Shabbos Kest. And on Twitter, I'm Shabbos K. And
Shabbos is S-H-A-B-B-O-S.
Yes. And I'd like to think I put some interesting content on there. I'm still new to the social media game, but I think I'm doing an okay job.
I think so. I think your strength, your power, the thing you bring to the world is that you break molds. You started with not wanting to put any labels. Well, it really is hard to put a label on you, right?
Good. As
politically, ideologically, religiously, you are you. And so here I am with Shabbos Kestenbaum.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Michael Greenspan, Shai's father-in-law. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Here I Am podcast with Shai Davidai. Here I Am is recorded at the Cave Production House in Hackensack, New Jersey, and is brought to you in partnership with Abby Sophia and Adamit Productions. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. I'd also like to extend my deepest gratitude to everyone at Adamit Productions for turning Shai's dream into a reality, and to all our donors and partners for their unwavering commitment to fighting for Jewish civil rights. Most importantly, I'd like to thank you, our listeners. Let's be honest, none of this would have been possible without your support and dedication. Showing up is half the battle. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for being there. Thank you for saying, "Here I am."